I remember it was about in 2017 that there was this lady who came from Botswana, and she was actually, she was going to launch her novel, and this novel is called The Scattering. And she was there, and she was, you know, she was talking about the novel, and she said, I said, what is the novel about? And I had taken my Herero students there, and she said, what is the novel about? I asked her. She said, oh, it's a love story, you know, it's a love story. And then they get caught up, you know, the young lovers get caught up in the genocide. So I said, did it bother you that the genocide happened, and what kind of research did you do? And she said, I don't care about the genocide. She was not a Botswana, okay? She came from Botswana. She said, I don't care about the genocide. The love story is important for me, you know? And of course, at that point, my students were horrified. They were very angry. And when I went back next day and I started talking to them, they were very upset. I said, no, no, you can't be upset. You have to tell your stories. You can't expect other people to tell your stories. And so that is how the project started. I started working with the Herero people. Mm-hmm. And I have to first acknowledge them, the elders in the community, because they were the ones who shared their stories with me. So we started this project with funding from Basler Africa. So I'd like to also acknowledge Basler Africa Bibliography that gave me the funding to conduct this research. And this is what the research is about. I think this is a very important book, The Kaiser's Holocaust, Germany's Forgotten Genocide by Olusoga and Erickson. They say the Herero genocide is acknowledged as the first genocide of the 20th century. Quite a number of people don't know about this, and I'll tell you why. I went to a conference, which is the International Association of Genocide Scholars, and this was in Cambodia. And there were nearly 350 scholars there. Of the 350 scholars, there were just three of us from the African continent. And of the three from the African continent, it was myself, my colleague from Namibia, and one gentleman from Zimbabwe. And nobody had heard about the Herero genocide. Nobody. So that is the kind of lack of exposure. Lothar von Trotha was, he was a general who, actually the general who was in Namibia at that point, during the 1888 onwards, right up to 1904, it was General Leutwein. And he had a very good understanding relationship with the Hereros. Of course, there are people who contest that also, okay? But what happened was that he was replaced by General von Trotha. And it was at that point that he took a very strong and a very serious stand against the Hereros, because the Hereros had guns and they could fight. And so General von Trotha felt that he needed to exterminate all the Hereros, and that is the order. And you see, if you look at Raphael Lemkin, and Raphael Lemkin, as you know, was a Polish Jew who went to the United States. He escaped the Holocaust, went to the United States, and he was the first one who actually formulated the word genocide. He articulated genocide. And if you look at how he defines it and describes it, you find that the first thing that happens in a genocide is that there should be intent, that you have an intention to kill. And here, very clearly in von Trotha's document, he says, if you don't leave, I will kill all of you. So the intention is very clearly stated there. And of course, 80,000 people, that's 80% of the Hereros, were killed. First of all, because they were shot by the Germans. Secondly, because, you know, they were forced to, you know, at one point in the Ohomakari battle, they said, let us not waste any bullets. And so what they did is they forced them to run into the desert. So a lot of the Hereros went into the desert, and people were sent, the soldiers were sent on horseback to the waterholes to go and poison all of them. So a lot of the Hereros went to the poison holes, to the water holes, and they died because they drank that water. A lot of the prisoners were hanged during the 1904-1908 war. And let me describe to you a little bit about the detail of this particular hanging. This hanging did not happen with ropes. It happened with iron rods, with wires, thick wires. So you can imagine the kind of pain, you can imagine the torture, you can imagine the brutality with which they were killed. And if you go to, and that's a picture that I have taken, in fact, and you see the tree is still there. You see the tree is still there, a part of the branches has fallen, and at one end you can actually see those iron rods even today. You understand? And for me, maybe I will talk about this later, but let me just touch upon this particular point. There is nothing, this particular tree is, you know, it's in an enclosed space, there is a wire fence, but there isn't any board, there isn't anything to say this is where they were hung. Whatever knowledge is there, it is there in the memory of the Herero people. 1904 to 1908, I've already mentioned the fact that quite a number of people died. But then I think they realized that, you know, you needed the Herero people to do labor, to work. And so what they did is they started rounding up all the Hereros and the Namas, and this is where the Namas came in, and they took them to Swakopmund and to the concentration camp. So you have concentration camps in Windhoek, you have it in Swakopmund, and you have it in Lüderitz. Some of them were taken in wagons, some of them were forced to walk, and they were all taken. And if you travel to Namibia and if you've gone to Swakopmund, you know how cold it is. Lüderitz, it's absolutely bone-chillingly cold. You cannot survive in that cold if you're wearing leather skins. And during the time, the Herero people were actually living in the central part of Namibia, which is not that cold. You know, the temperatures don't go below zero. And so quite a number of people died because of the cold. There was no way they could light the fire to keep themselves warm. And secondly, they were not given meat to eat, because Hereros are generally, and I'm sure they'll be able to talk about this a lot more tomorrow when we have these discussions. You know, the Herero people eat a lot of beef. They completely rely on the cattle for milk and for beef and, you know, all the products from the milk. And of course, if you give them rice, how are they going to cook it? There are no utensils, there is no fire, there is no way you can cook the fire. So a lot of people died because of starvation. A lot of people died because they tried to eat it, and because of diarrhea they died. And of course, there was also the experimentation that a lot of people were injected with diseases because they wanted to see what would be the it was like a laboratory. It was like a laboratory to see what would happen to these people if they were injected. Hard labor, these people were made to break stones and of course lay the railway line, and you know that. Okay, and then of course you have the skulls of 17 Herero people which were sent to Germany for research, and they were cleaned by Herero women and returned in 2017. And I think yesterday in his poetry, Prince talked about this, you know, how painful it would have been for a woman to now scrape the skull. And I started with the Nama genocide, and I will talk to you a little bit about that. I finished with the Herero genocide, the documentary is there, but now I also started the Nama genocide. Again, I've got funding from Basler. And I went to this particular, I went deep down into the south of Namibia to a place called Gambies, and I met this Boendel Swartz gentleman. And he talked about his grandmother. He said that he's about my age, a little older than me, and he said that he knew his grandmother, and his grandmother said that she was around a 17 or an 18 year old girl when she was taken to the camp, okay? And she was brutally raped every night, multiple times. So she decided, I'm not going to be there, let me rather go into the kitchen and clean, you know, do the cleaning work. And she went into the kitchen and they were boiling something, and they said, you have to clean the skulls. And when she started cleaning the skull, she discovered that it was her own husband's, and she got mad. Understand? So those are the stories. These are the stories that are coming out from our narratives. When we talk to the people, those are the stories that are being told to us. You see, all these four novels, which have been written by foreigners, the first one has been written by a Russian living in the United States, the second one by an American married to a Botswana living in Botswana, the third is by a British, and the fourth is by a South African. All these novels have been written about the Herero Nama genocide, but they've all been written by foreigners. The only two original writings by Hereros themselves. This first, Mama Pene, Transcending the Genocide. This is by Kapombo Kachivena. And of course, you have Ruki Chingelte, who's written about, he calls it the weeping graves of our ancestors. So these are only two texts. Can you imagine? Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about this one, Marie Serebrov, because I've met Kapombo Kachivena, and he told me the story himself. This Mama Namibia is a story about a 13-year-old girl who managed to survive the genocide. And the story is very powerful, very moving, because she managed, there is this particular incident where she's hiding, you know, among the corpses. And the, you know, the soldiers come there to check her, and they, and then she's scared that you know, they will find her, and she grits her teeth and she lays low because she does not want to be killed by the soldiers. And there is a python that crawls over her and passes by. You understand? And of course, she escapes luckily. And then imagine a 13-year-old girl finding her way from the Waterberg Mountains, walking all the way to Omaheke, traversing a distance of 600, 700 kilometers, 1,000 kilometers, and finding her people. Her parents, everybody died, but then she is able to find some Herero people and come back, and she becomes a maid. Now, Kapombo, this is the story of Kapombo Kachivena's own grandmother, Mama Pene. And this is this story, Kapombo Kachivena, when he was a student in New York, he shared it with one of the Americans there. And what did they do? That lady?
Stole it.
And she wrote the novel. You see, so this was in fact presented, they say it was presented to the traditional chief, and he said, we will bury it. And so this novel is not sold anywhere in Namibia. You cannot find it. So you see, we're not just talking about the loss of lives, because how many people died? 80,000, I said. 20,000 Namas. We're also talking about history being stolen. We're also talking about intellectual property being lost. So the memorialization, the archiving that is taking place is oral. It's orality, and it is precious. And of course, what do we talk about? We talk about libraries. We talk about written material. We don't seem to acknowledge the oral memories. We need to capture these stories, because if we don't record the stories, they will disappear, because people died. A lot of people went to Botswana, they went to the north, they went to the south. So the Hereros are scattered. And of course, quite a number of Hereros are also there in Cameroon, I'm told. And so the research methodology, as I said, a snowballing technique. We had 25 interviews. Everywhere we were very particular that we wanted to talk to people who were above the age of 7, above the age of 80. Because we wanted to talk to people who had direct relationship with the survivors. So somebody who had grown up with a grandmother or a grandfather who had survived, or a grand uncle who had survived. But generally, on the whole, we were very well received, and they were ready to share. The Herero people were ready to share their stories with us, because they said, how is it? In fact, I remember, and you will see this tomorrow, the Erika Mbapo, she was the first person we interviewed. And she said, who is this woman? Where did she come from? Because she wouldn't have seen an Indian woman at all, right? Where do you come from? Why are you here? Why are you doing this research and not my children? You understand? I said, no, I'm not doing this research. I'm just enabling the research, because I keep myself in the background. I want the Herero people to do this. I want the Herero people to come out with this. I want them to tell the story. So that's that was the emphasis. Of course, a lot of people talked about the Omakari attack. That was the very first attack that happened. And then, of course, there were stories of survival. How did they survive the desert? How did they dig roots? How did they manage to? And I think one of the stories that Prince beautifully presented yesterday, he talked about how the women gave their breast milk to their husbands, sacrificing their own babies. And we went to this village called Omaihi. And Omaihi in Oshiherero means milk. Now, can you imagine the pain of this mother who has to leave her baby behind, because the men said that we need to survive, and if the man survives, tomorrow there will be another baby. So those were the kinds of sacrifices. I mean, I was listening to the stories, remember, I was listening to these stories which are being translated. And in the translation, I don't know how much was lost. I'm sure a lot was lost. And in the translation, whatever I could get, I was sitting and weeping, because it was so painful to listen to. And this is, we're talking about three generations later. I'll talk tomorrow about transgenerational trauma, because this continues. The Herero people, even today, feel the pain. It's not forgotten. Everybody, every person is conscious of this, and they feel the pain even today. So they talked about survival. Of course, a lot of stories are around the concentration camp. And then, of course, identity. I think he also mentioned identity. Identity is so important. Identity, particularly for the Oshiriro people, is very important because of the fact that they're very proud of their culture, the Oshiriro people. And Tateye, Tate Banda will talk about it, how you're so proud of your culture, you're proud of the artifice, you're proud of the holy fire. These are cultural practices which are there even today. If you go into the village, you will never find the kitchen inside the house. It is built outside. Outside, and you will not park your car in front of the house, the door of the house. There are these traditions, these cultural practices that are in existence even today. And for us, we think it's meaningless, but there is a meaning, and that's what we need to understand. We need to have the openness and the generosity of spirit to accept there are cultural practices which are different from ours, and that we need to understand what it is all about before we dismiss it, saying, this is all rubbish. No, there is meaning for every, and I'm sure they will be able to talk about this much, much more tomorrow, particularly when they do the presentations of the cultural artifacts that has been collected in the museum here. They will be able to tell you in detail about some of these cultural practices. So identity is very, very important for the Hereru and the Nama people. I've told you already, I've started the Nama genocide. And of course, the big one is the reparation. And that is a very political issue now. Everybody's talking about reparation again. And this came out in the interviews. People were worried about the reparation. Remember I told you that this research was conducted 2 years ago. I finished my project last year and I submitted everything to PASLA last year. So during that time, they were talking about reparation. And they said, but why have you come? Are you speaking on behalf of the government? You know, so I said, no, I'm not. I'm just a pure researcher. I'm only interested in stories. I'm not interested in politics. And once they were convinced that that's what I'm interested in, they were willing to share their stories with me. So, of course, the reparation and land issues is a very thorny topic. And a lot of people talked about it. And, of course, I must mention the fact that, you know, the women consistently, I think of the 23, 25 or 28 people whom we interviewed, there were about 12 women. And these 12 women, all of them said, we don't want money, we want schools for our children. We want education for our children. You know, they say reparation, money, land, that's for all those people, you know, for the higher ups. But for us, we want children. Right across, whether they were in Ochinene, they were in Waterberg, they were in Ovitoto, any of the villages, any of the regions. We went to 4 regions. In every region, these women wouldn't have talked to each other, but all of them said, we want our children to be educated. Understand? So this is a very moving experience for me. Next. Yes, I mean, a land for resettlement and all that is political, but the women consistently, and he'll talk about it more, but women consistently in my research, they all said we want schools to be built. Whatever has been published on the Herero genocide, the Herero Nama genocide, has been done by the German scholars, by the European scholars. What about African scholars? Very few people. And now I think there is one lady who has finished a PhD from UNAM who has published, who's finished a PhD. I was an examiner last year. So there is very little research being done. And I want my Namibian people to do their research in these topics. Because I think there's a greater understanding. There is a lot of inherent, as I said, you know, there is a lot of memory that is already there, which I don't have access to because I'm not a Herero. Understand? Of course. And then, of course, we talk about decoloniality. And decoloniality is so important for us. And this is what I try to do even in my classes when I teach world literature. I don't teach British literature at all. I'm teaching English, but I don't teach British literature. The only one text that I teach is Tempest by Shakespeare, because Tempest talks about colonization.